book because I think the book speaks for itself so much.
You want to sit down?
It's okay. I'll stand. So, I feel like I can piggyback off of the two prior speakers. So, Kathy was talking about autobiography, how she loves to read biographies. And I've been reading a lot of autobiographies lately. And I found it's really helpful. Just getting, basically, like, putting things into perspective. Oh. Like, do you guys remember when Arthur is talking about, like, the basketball player who, like, always does that really high-pressure shot, and they're like, how do you make it every time? And he's like, because that's not real pressure, right? Because he had a daughter who was, like, battling cancer. He's like, that's real pressure when you're, like, fighting for your life. And books do that. They put your perspective, you know, back where it should be, and it helps because you're looking through someone else's perspective. So, like, there were, like, a lot of books that I was thinking through, like, one that's from the perspective of a lesbian feminist English professor, and that's Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert, and there's one from the perspective of a devout Muslim, and then their journey to Christ, and that's in Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, and then there's, you know, She Is Mine, the perspective from an abandoned orphan, you know, so all of those are really eye-opening kinds of perspectives. But the book that I chose was The Hiding Place. And I know Sandra, she mentions it in her freshman Sunday school class sometimes. But this one is really from the other end. So, like, while the other books that I just mentioned are from the perspective of the receiving end, people coming to know Christ through those who do know Christ, this is from the perspective of the one who is giving a reason for the hope that is in them. And it's really amazing. Like, Corrie Ten Boom, you guys know who she is? She was the daughter of a watchmaker, and then she herself became, like, the first certified watchmaker in Holland. And she was, like, all the way until she never married, so she was, like, in her 50s, I think, when the Holocaust happened. And then basically their family got drawn into, like, the underground of smuggling Jews and protecting them, and then she kind of shares her journey. But actually, like, this half of the book is just about, like, the majority of her life, where it's just, like, very normal, really, like, just, like, doing life together, celebrating with family. But then everything changes, but at the same time it doesn't change. It's kind of like what Daniel was saying, how beauty comes out of the tension between how things are and how things should be. And then you kind of see how, at the core, because of who they are, what they do, like, what happens to them later, doesn't change who they are, but in fact it deepens and it purifies and refines what's already there. So, the people, there's, like, two people who helped co-write this book, and when they were at a German church service, they were saying how they heard two speakers. The first speaker was one who, you know, went through the Nazi concentration camp, and you could tell, like, his eyes were haunted and his hands were shaking. But then this woman, white-haired woman, came up with a face that radiated joy and love and peace. And they're like, this reaction, like, the first reaction we understand, but where did the second one come from? You know, and then, so that inexplicable kind of response to such intense, unexplainable suffering is something that, like, you see her kind of expositing. So I think The Hiding Place is really amazing in that, you know, there's plenty of really good books, like, by John MacArthur, John Piper, Paul Miller, that really talk about, like, who God is and all of these, like, deep theological truths. But in this book, you see those same truths lived out. And so it's like, so there's a couple of themes. Like, what true love is, what true suffering is, what true faith is, true thankfulness, true worth. So I'm going to just read a couple of excerpts. Okay, so you're introduced in the story. It starts off with the 100th birthday of the watch shop. So they're in Holland, and then, you know, it's already two generations of watchmakers, and they make, repair, and sell watches. And then Papa is, he's almost like a clock in himself, because he's so consistent and so regular. And so every morning, like at exactly 8:30, he'll open the Bible and he'll start reading one chapter, and then they'll pray, and then they'll start working. And then every night at 8:45 p.m., they'll get together again, and then he'll open the Bible and they'll read a chapter from Scripture and then pray and then go to bed. So it's like everything's really, really regular. And now the Chans have to go to bed. Good night. So you see like that steadfastness and consistency in his schedule. But in addition to that, you also see like his just the way he approaches his work. So people would come and visit them, and a lot of times it was a customer. More often it was simply a visitor, from a laborer with wooden clompton on his feet to a fleet owner, all bringing their problems to Father, quite unabashedly. In the sight of customers in the front room and the employees working with us, he would bow his head and pray for the answer. He prayed over the work, too. There weren't many repair problems he hadn't encountered, but occasionally one would come across that baffled even him. And then I would hear him say, "Lord, you turn the wheels of the galaxies. You know what makes the planets spin, and you know what makes this watch run." The specifics of the prayer were always different. For Father, who loved science, was an avid reader of a dozen university journals. Through the years, he took his stopwatches to the one who set the atoms dancing, or to the who keeps the great currents circling through the sea. And then God would like give him the answer in the middle of the night. So it's just, it's really neat to see how he weaved, you know, his, like, you see it's not just like staying in one area of his life, but it flows over into his work. And then after all of his children, he had three children, and the oldest brother, Willem, and then, Willem, Betsy, Nolly, and then Corey, four children. So Corey is the youngest, and she's the one who writes this, second youngest. But anyway, after they all like grew up, it said like Father could never bear a house without children, and whenever he heard of a child in need of a home, a new face would appear at the table. Somehow, out of his watch shop that never made money, he fed and dressed and cared for 11 more children after his own four were grown. So you see like the hospitality, like that consistency is not only within his thinking, but it flows out into his actions. So his being results in his doing. And then with his mom, with her mom, Mama, she's also, so like how Papa reflects that steadfastness and consistency, she reflects this incredible love and generosity. And so she's really like sick for most of her life, and eventually she has a brain hemorrhage, I think, and she like loses her ability to, she's like paralyzed and loses her ability to speak. And so she's kind of like trapped in this body. But then even though they're so poor, you know, when the kids were growing up, they said, "We never saw ourselves as poor, because the poor people are the ones that you bring baskets to." Because they were always going to, you know, like, and I really like in the beginning of the, when they're talking about Mama, they said, "Mama could have coffee on the stove and a cake in the oven as fast as most people could say best wishes." And since she knew almost everyone in Harlem, the city, the town they lived in, especially the poor, sick, and neglected, there was almost no day in the year that was not for somebody. And she would say with eyes shining, "A very special occasion." And so even after she's like bedridden, and like basically she had to stay in her room like for her whole life, and then her daughter Corey would come and bring food to her, and then she would like be writing a letter, and she would say, Corey, just think of it, you know, that poor old man who's trapped. She said he doesn't get to like see any sun or clouds. And then Corey looks out the window and it's like a brick wall, you know? And so it's like, she's showing pity to the same, to people who are in her situation, you know? But then for herself, she sees herself as so rich, you know? And so like just that kind of, and then this is what we call an eternal perspective, right? Because they see with eyes beyond the reality of how things are. And that's where that like seeming tension comes in. And the whole family is like this. It seems like everyone except for Corey is like this, where like when the Nazis start coming and they abuse people, and then Corey would say like, oh, those poor people. And then her dad said, yes, those poor people. I pity the Germans, for they have touched the apple of God's eye. You know, or like when Betsy is also, she's the oldest sister, and she's also sick. And so, a lot of times, like ever since she was growing up, she could only do boring adult stuff, like knitting and that kind of thing. But she also has this gift of seeing beyond what's there. And so she's actually the one who's like, the one who accompanies Corey most of the time when they get caught smuggling Jews, and they suffer together. But the entire time, like, you have these vicious Nazis, like, torturing them and abusing them. And then Nolly would just be saying, oh, sorry, Betsy, she would say, like, oh, you know, once we're out of this camp, we can set up a home for them. And then Corey is thinking, oh, she must be talking about, like, these, like, the victims. And then Betsy goes on to say, like, flowers. Flowers teach you how to love. Like, it brings healing. So that these people can be taught to hate. They can be taught to love, too. And then Corey's like, she's talking about the Nazis. Like, she's talking about these people who are torturing us, that we can set up a home to care for them and teach them how to love. You know, and so you can see, like, and even when they, like, hit Betsy, and, like, she's, like, bleeding down her cheek. And then Corey sees her, she's like, Corey, Betsy, you're hurt. And then Betsy says, oh, yes, I feel so sorry for him. You know, and it's like, you know, it's just like, and a lot of times Corey is also like, who is this sister? It's like, she doesn't belong to this world. You know, and then, so the forgiveness that Betsy shows, it's like, it's also just from having such a deeply embedded understanding of what it means to be forgiven and to have heaven as your home. You know, and so all of the things, all of these horrors that happen are, like, to her are, like, just so fleeting. Like, she knows it's going to be over instantly. And so, like, she's sitting in the concentration camp with these, like, horrible prison clothes that, like, are super uncomfortable. And yet she, like, manages to, like, button it up really high and decently. And she just sits in, like, that, like, a prison chair as if it's, like, a cushioned armchair in front of a hot fireplace. You know, and so, like, the way that she carries herself, it's, like, yeah, it's just, like, it doesn't make sense. And so, yeah, with Betsy, you see that. And then Willem, the oldest brother, he also, like, basically gave his life to, like, try to protect the seniors, like, because, you know, they also, the Nazis also, like, despised the aged, right, because there are no practical benefits to society. So, like, the aged, the Jews, the, like, anyone who's, like, seemingly weak. And Willem, like, he had a senior home, and then he started disguising people, like, to look like girls, so they wouldn't be able to. So he sacrificed a lot, and you see a lot of his resourcefulness. Like, he kind of heads a lot of the underground. And when they find out that, okay.
I want to read a little more. But basically, you see how, like, God proved his faithfulness, like, by providing for them, but he provides through the faithfulness that the ten booths showed. So you know how, like, they're friends with, like, the entire town, right? Because they ministered to all of the poor, sick, and needy there. So when, like, ration cards, like, they needed to find their own sources for, like, ration cards or for, like, housing, like, to find connections and stuff, they realized, whoa, like, we know everyone here. And so, that, like, God provided in that way. And then their rickety old house that was, like, super, super crooked, and they're just, like, it was kind of inconvenient to live in. It became the perfect structure to create a secret room to hide Jews in. And so all of these things that they couldn't plan, God planned. And so it said, so Bilam told her, like, I'm being watched. Like, if you need something, you can't ask me. You have to find your own sources. So she just kept on thinking, develop your own sources. And then she realized, there's an uncanny realization growing in me. We were friends with half of Harlem. We knew nurses in the maternity hospital. We knew clerks in the records office. We knew someone in every business and service in the city. We didn't know, of course, the political views of all these people, but, and here I felt a strange leaping of my heart, God did. My job was simply to follow his leading one step at a time, holding every decision up to him in prayer. I knew I was not a clever or subtle or sophisticated. If our home was becoming a meeting place for need and supply, it was through some strategy far higher than mine. And so, yeah, like, faithfulness leading to faith, leading to faithfulness. You can see how, like, taking those steps of faith, you see God proving his faithfulness. And all of this, like, you see, really just, like, in all of these characteristics that I just described, all of them are just small reflections of who Christ is. And so you see, like, through each person, not who they are, how inherently generous or loving or forgiving they are, but really, like, how they are, like, reflections of who Christ is in the way they love. And she makes that really clear in every, like, situation, like, whenever, like, they do something that seems like, why would you do that? And, like, wow, you're such a good person. And she's like, that did not come from me. And there's, like, so many more things that I want to share. But so I'm going to think. Okay, so, yeah, I'll just end with just when she realizes, what it meant. One more. She has one more sister called Nolly. Nolly never lies. So when the Nazis came in to, like, bang on the door and say, do you have any young men, like, in your, you know, in your house for us to enlist? And then they're like, you know, and then they're like, well, there's us. And then they're like, well, do you have brothers? And the little girl who's been trained by her mom basically says, like, yeah. And then they're like, well, where are they? And they're like, well, the oldest one is in seminary. Well, where are the younger ones? And then she's like, they're under the table. And they were under the table. And they're like, what are you doing, right? And then so they start to, like, lift the table. And then the little girl starts to, like, laugh uncontrollably. And then they're like, do you think we're fools? And then they leave. And then, like, the boys come out from under the table. And they're just like, you know. And then you're just like, you guys are crazy. Like, what are you doing? And so Corey is, like, wrestling with that, too. You know, is it a sin to lie? And I think that's when, like, Sandra brings it up in Sunday school. And then, you know, Corey is just like, you know, isn't that hypocrisy? Because you're lying with your actions. Like, so, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. But so she's like, love. Like, how does one show it? How could God himself show truth and love at the same time in a world like this? by dying. The answer stood out for me sharper and chiller than it ever had before that night, the shape of a cross etched on the history of the world. So, yeah, like, as they go through the suffering, like, the torture, like, they start to, like, find it harder and harder to reconcile, like, how this kind of cruelty can exist. And, like, all of this seemingly pointless suffering. Every day something else fails to make sense. But as the rest of the world grew stranger, one thing became increasingly clear. And that was the reason the two of us, Betsy and Corey, were here. Why others should suffer, we were not shown. And as for us, from morning until lights out, whenever we were not in ranks for roll call, our Bible was the center of an ever-widening circle of help and hope. So they managed to smuggle a Bible into the concentration camp, and then they would have, like, tiny, like, church services, and all of the prisoners would come around, and, like, all of the prisoners in their barracks were transformed. And so you see, like, not just the preciousness of the word, and as you read, like, you see, like, wow, there is this Bible is so powerful, and it is so precious, and it is meant to be shared. And so that's something that she realizes more and more and more during her experience. And they crowded around it like it was a blazing fire, and they held out their hearts to its warmth and light. The blacker the night around us grew, the brighter and truer and more beautiful burned the word of God. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Nay, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him that loves us. I would look about us, as Betsy read, watching the light leap from face to face, more than conquerors. It was not a wish, it was a fact. We knew it, we experienced it, minute by minute, poor, hated, hungry. We are more than conquerors. Not we shall be, we are. Life in this concentration camp took place on two separate levels, mutually impossible. One, the observable external life grew every day more horrible. The other, the life we lived with God, grew daily better, truth upon truth, glory upon glory. Sometimes I would slip the Bible from its little sack with hands that shook. So mysterious it had come to me. It was new. It had just been written. I marveled sometimes that the ink was dry. I had believed the Bible always, but reading it now had nothing to do with belief. It was simply a description of the way things were, of hell and heaven, of how men act and how God acts. I had read 1,000 times the story of Jesus' arrest, how soldiers had laughed at him, flogged him. Now such happenings had faces and voices. Yeah. So, yeah, you just see, like, the more you, the more you, like, step into that life of obedience, the more the word comes alive, and the more you need to depend on the word. And, like, there's plenty of other, like, stories to bookmark in here, like when she experienced heartbreak. But, like, something that she said, like when she was sharing at the German church event thing, it was, like, all of the things that she said, like, shared were, like, super relatable, even though, like, none of us have gone through that kind of suffering. But we could relate to everything that she shared. And then when they told her that, she said, but of course, this is what the past is for. Every experience God gives us, every person he puts in our lives is the perfect preparation for the future that only he can see. And so, like, you can see, like, especially, like, the first half of the book, which is, like, kind of mundane, just, like, everyday life impacts, you know, like, the little things impact the big things. And so how we're living now is going to determine how we, you know, like, the future that awaits us. So, So, yeah, I really, I highly recommend this book.
It's one of the books I read as a young Christian.
It really was quite impactful.